Welcome to the American Jewish Medical Association podcast, The Jewish Voice of Health. I'm your host, Bob Belfer. On today's podcast, we are only going to begin our journey by speaking with doctors involved, either directly or indirectly, in caring for battlefield injuries suffered by Israeli Defense Force soldiers and Israeli physicians. It is my pleasure to welcome Drs. Anna Goldenberg and Phil Quern, both physicians at Cooper University Hospital in Camden, New Jersey, who brought a unique educational initiative to our Israeli physician colleagues. Welcome, Anna and Phil.
Thank you.
So what I want to do, if it's all right with you, Anna and Phil, is tailor this discussion with both of you as a sort of primer on trauma care. Okay? So first, let's get to know a little bit about you, Phil. Tell us, I know you're not a trauma surgeon, so you'll have to explain what type of doctor you are. And again, we're going to talk about the ASSET educational program shortly, but just tell us your involvement in getting this initiative underway. Go ahead, Phil.
So as a background, I am a interventional cardiologist. I practice cardiology at Cooper, like you said, at Cooper University Healthcare, which is a large academic tertiary care center in a large urban area. We're at right outside Philadelphia. And I run the heart program. I also am associate CMO of health system. And so we're involved in a lot of cool things. And Anna will share with you a little bit about our military programs at Cooper. And my involvement was really based on Anna's initiative. And Anna will share with you her initiative. And this gave me an opportunity to really express my interest in being involved in what's going on in Israel. Having grown up going to Israel and spending many weeks in Israel and a lot of time with family and friends in Israel, I was personally invested in doing something hands-on as opposed to being a passive participant watching the news every day. I wanted to do something.
Great.
So this gave us an opportunity.
Thank you, Phil. Anna, a trauma surgeon at Cooper Hospital. Nice to meet a trauma surgeon. Tell us, we're going to talk a little bit about your day-to-day life at Cooper, but just tell us, what is your connection to Israel, both from a family perspective and, more importantly, with this initiative, your professional connection to Israel?
Thank you so much, Bob. So this is really multi-layer for me. You know, I've been at Cooper now. It's going to be 10 years as an attending. I'm Cooper born and bred. You know, I was a fellow there. So, you know, daily life at Cooper is just gunshot, stabbing, high-speed motor vehicle. So really, really busy, mature trauma system. You know, we have top-notch surgeons. We have top-notch specialists, neurosurgery, orthopedics, medicine, cardiology. So everything is right there for us. You know, Cooper Hospital really breathes trauma. It's what we're known for. People come there for fellowships. People come there, you know, to be taken care of because they know, you know, the outcomes are so good. I also spent a lot of my childhood going to Israel. My brother lives there. My nieces live there. I have a lot of family there. But for me, this initiative after October 7th was really, really personal. In 2020, we had a fellow. He trained in the United States, did all his general surgery residency, and came to us for trauma fellowship, Shachar Shimonovich. And he was a beautiful human, amazing person, amazing physician, amazing trauma surgeon. And after he was done with the fellowship, he went back to Israel. We kept in touch for a really, really long time. He was really into teaching ASSET here at Cooper, which we offer for free to our residents and a lot of the staff. He was very involved with our military program. He was just like a natural educator. And then he left. And about a year and a half after, he went to work at Ichilov, which is also, you know, a very mature, you know, trauma center in the middle of Tel Aviv. And as he left, we started talking about, hey, like, as time goes on, we should talk about doing collaborations, thinking that we were going to have all this time in the world to work on ASSET and paramedics courses and all this stuff. Well, fast forward a year and a half later, he was diagnosed with metastatic colon cancer, and he was 35 years old. So after that, he spent a couple of months, you know, really struggling with the journey of dying, right? He knew he was dying. And on October 8th, right after October 7th, I was really, really angry. I mean, angry at his diagnosis, but also really angry about what happened. Just, I couldn't imagine. And somehow I had a pivot on my emotions and I texted him, I WhatsApped him and I said, Shakar, I said, I know you're going to die. I said, we know. He had like three, four months to live and he was very self-aware of that. And I said, this is the time. I said, we have to do this now. I said, this is the legacy course. I said, the countries at war, we're going straight into Gaza. And he for 3 months until January, he died January 9th. We spent 3 months planning this. And he basically at the end of his life, up until the very last days where he was, you know, encephalopathic and couldn't text me anymore, he spent time emailing back and forth, planning the cadavers, connecting me to trauma surgeons at various hospitals through Israel that had experience on October 7th that some of them had taken ACET in the United States as a fellow. And that's like, again, we'll have to talk about, you know, the training that happens. And we planned this whole thing in the last, you know, couple of months of his life. And we actually dedicated this, the course to him, an inaugural course. And it was really, really powerful for me to do that. And that's how I channeled a lot of my frustration about what's going on in America, but also my fears and anger about what was going on in Israel.
Anna, that's an unbelievable story. And to have this program, which we're going to talk a lot more about, as a legacy in memorial for that doctor who was a fellow for years at Cooper, it makes it that much more important. Let's go back a little bit. Let's, Anna, I know you're not an Israeli trauma surgeon, but I want to talk about what's going on in Israel as far as trauma care. And I want to bring up a term, remote damage control resuscitation. Dr. Ilan Glassberg, who I know attended your ACET course in Israel, former IDF chief medical officer, he and his colleagues realized that bleeding is the leading cause of preventable death on the battlefield. So he and his team initiated a lot of pre-hospital care. And that's what the IDF medical people do, pre-hospital. Once they get to the hospital, the Israeli doctors take over. So one thing they did, and Anna, I want to get your opinion, for over 10 years in the field, they've been giving freeze-dried plasma and or, I know I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, but tranexamic acid, TXA, we call it, pre-hospital. Talk about, first of all, what they do there. And Anna, do we do that in the United States?
So their pre-hospital system is a lot different. They're, let's say from the military standpoint, right? So, you know, America's experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, which two of the partners that came with me, Dr. Kirby Gross, who's the most deployed surgeon in all of United States history, you know, a phenomenal man, has been on every battlefield and has taken care of hundreds of injured American soldiers. Same with my partner, John Chavanis. Both trained Shakar and felt very, very, you know, inclined to go with me to Israel, even in time of war, were very supportive of this mission. There's a different perspective. In Israel, Israel's a really small country. So pre-hospital care means that when you place a tourniquet or when you give freeze-dried plasma in Gaza, in 6 minutes or 8 minutes, the patient's going to be at Sheba via helicopter. So that short hospital time is really kind of the hospital time that we experience for civilians at Cooper. In the United States military, it's not the same, right? To get from Afghanistan to Germany to Walter Reed is a much different beast. So in the civilian world and now on the battlefield, combat medics do all those things. We don't do freeze-dried plasma in America. We're looking into it because it's not FDA approved yet. Great. The Red Cross has a different component of freeze-dried plasma. We do give pre-hospital TXA, and that's been proven, you know, to help coagulation. But a lot of hospitals in the United States give whole blood. They give whole blood on the EMS trucks, and they give whole blood in the helicopters. Cooper's not doing that yet, but we're on our way to getting whole blood on all of our helicopters and EMS vehicles. So,
right. So, Anna, you not only need to replace what's being lost, okay, and stop it from being lost, but also controlling the bleeding. You sort of mentioned tourniquets. There's something called combat application tourniquet. And then for those lesions that can't be tourniquet can't be used, some type of quick clot combat gauze is being applied. So talk to us about ways to control the bleeding while you're infusing blood products.
Absolutely. So stop the bleed, right? The concepts of stop the bleed came from Sandy Hook, right? The Sandy Hook massacre of all those children, that's where Stop the Bleed came from. Stop the Bleed now is taught in every school system throughout America. You know, we go out as trauma surgeons and teach it to elementary schools. I've taught it at my kids' elementary school, high schools, junior high schools, churches, synagogues, JCCs. We've taught it everywhere. And really the concept of hemorrhage control is either application of a tourniquet, if you have a tourniquet available, which many places now do, or people carry them around. I actually have tourniquets in my car. I give them to friends and I say, hey, take this. You have to know how to properly apply a tourniquet. You'd be surprised because a lot of people don't know how to properly apply a tourniquet. It's either too loose, too tight, not tight. You know, it doesn't work if it's not applied properly. The other concept is point pressure, right? Hemorrhage control, a lot of the time when you have a major vascular injury, that junk for junctional hemorrhage in the groin, in the armpit, in the neck. You can't put a tourniquet on somebody's neck unless you really hate them. So what you have to do is you have to stand there and you have to hold point pressure. That's another thing with you. And we don't say point pressure with just a bunch of gauze thrown onto their neck, which used to be the old motto, right? Just like throw a bunch of gauze on and see what happens. Well, what's going to happen is they're going to bleed to death. So really direct point pressure, deep packing, like you said, with the combat gauze to fill the cavity and try to tamponade some of that bleeding. So we teach that universally.
So early implementation of blood products in the field and these control of bleeding pre-hospital, both are feasible and outcomes, improve outcomes?
100%.
Okay.
100%.
All right. Let's shift gears now. Okay. Let's talk about October 7th. Soroka Medical Center in Be'er Sheva, the only tertiary care medical center in southern Israel, and actually the only level one trauma center in the region, 25 miles from Gaza. And it gets a little scarier. Terrorist activity took place as close as 6 miles from the hospital on October 7th. On October 7th, 2023, Phil and Anna, one of the largest mass casualty events in history. Anna, can you ever plan for this volume and acuity of patients? What do you do with Cooper? You have mass casualty simulations.
We have a mass casualty committee. Dr. Shivanis, Dr. Porter, my chair is on that committee. We also have Dr. Sarkazian, who's actually an expert in mass casualties, a military emergency medicine doctor. So even at Cooper, even in the most mature trauma centers, that volume of patients we can never handle. Not only from a resource of blood, but also from just staffing, right? So it's like basically what ends up happening is that every hospital becomes a level one trauma center. And obviously the outcomes at various hospitals, just like if you're receiving trauma patients at centers that are just specializing in elective surgery, the outcomes of those patients are not going to be good. Because trauma's complicated. Trauma's really complicated. It's really scary for people. It's even scary for people who have been through trauma as a trauma rotator and as a general surgeon, right? You go on and you specialize in something else and you haven't seen a trauma case for 10 years. It's really scary for you. Bleeding is scary. And people really don't know what to do, not only from a hemorrhage control standpoint, but from a resuscitation standpoint. Which is, you know, they don't know the most common protocols, how we're supposed to resuscitate, what's the volume of blood to plasma to platelets, the TXA, the calcium replacement. It's really, really complicated for people.
Right. Let's talk about those first few hours. So at Soroka Medical Center, like I said, 25 miles from Gaza, the first 16 hours, the emergency department treated 680 patients. 120 were critically wounded and cared for in a trauma unit. 120 patients. 96 surgeries were performed that day. You talked about blood, Anna. In the hospital setting, 200 units of blood were transfused.
200 is not that much, interestingly enough, because we've given patients up to 90 sometimes, one patient, 40 to 90.
Anna, you talk about mass casualty events and the load of patients. Can you even fathom? I'm sure you interacted and spoke with some of these doctors after the fact, but can you imagine being boots on the ground at Soroka Medical Center trauma unit that morning?
No, I, you know, we've trained at ASSET a couple of surgeons from that. Guy Galani is a phenomenal, phenomenal trauma surgeon, trained at Canada, amazing human. And he says a nightmare. It was a nightmare. Just from a logistics standpoint, from identification of people to then assessing who is, you know, sometimes when you have a mass casualty and the military is really good about doing this, battlefield is you have to treat the people that you know are going to survive, right? So if you have 10 people that are shot in the, you know, transcranial and you know they're not going to live, their outcomes are not going to be good, you have to basically leave those people to die. That's the truth. And then you have to move on to, you know, thoracoabdominal, abdominal penetrating trauma, things that you can really, you know, help. If some patients are just moribund, you can't help them. There's nothing you could do. So utilizing blood or resources on those patients is futile. That's a really hard decision for a physician to make. There's a story of a resident at Soroka who sent me an abstract when applying for, we made a Shakar scholarship, and the scholarship was to go to our national meeting in East, which is our national organization. So we were going to pay for this an applicant to go. Great. He sent me an abstract. He was a second year surgical resident running a field hospital next to Soroka. He treated 40 patients. This is a second year surgical resident who did procedures that he's probably never done. Multiple chest tubes, emergent airways, hemorrhage control, transfusions, right? All he had to decide to do all these things. And unless he had a robust trauma experience, I give him a lot of credit. Like most people, even in America, wouldn't know what to do.
All right. Sounds like he really stepped up. Hopefully he did get that scholarship to come speak at the conference.
Yeah. Anna.
Yeah. Yeah. So back to Soroka, the first casualty arrived at 7:37 in the morning. The hospital declared a mass casualty event at 8 a.m. And they had processes in place by 9 a.m. 1 hour later, hundreds of additional doctors and nurses were on hand. Remember, this was the Sabbath, and it was also Simchas Torah. But again, hundreds of additional doctors and nurses arrived. Anna, you're a trauma surgeon, an educator, a researcher. We know the Israeli Defense Force physicians perform ongoing quality assurance, and hopefully we'll have them on in the future. They sort of tweak. What went right October 7th? What went wrong? But you actually noticed some gaps, or maybe your colleagues told you certain gaps, that led you to say, hey, we need to bring a team of educators to Israel. So what did you learn from them? And give us as a segue the happenings at Soroka on October 7th and the weeks and months since then to you developing with your team the ASSET program and traveling to Israel.
So the ASSET program, which really came out of the Department of Defense after Afghanistan and Iraq, and that came out by Dr. Boyer because we were making mistakes with the patient care. We were not proper. We were sending out surgeons to Iraq and Afghanistan that were missing injuries. And in that, you know, because of that, soldiers were dying. They were losing limbs. A classical thing is lower extremity compartment syndrome, right? That was a huge miss. A lot of soldiers lost their legs. So for us, ASSET, which is Advanced Surgical Skills and Trauma Exposure, is a standard of care. We teach it to residents that don't even want to go into trauma because they need to know, just in case, how to do 40 operations in a timed fashion. All of these are timed. That's 40 surgeries we teach, and it's all timed. We give a scenario, we show them how to do it, and then it's like, go, right? And then we have them teach it. So we have that. That's a luxury that we have. That's a luxury that Dr. Gross brought to Cooper. That's a really expensive course. A lot of physicians have to pay $3,000 to take it at other places. People take it as fellows. People take it as non-trauma fellows. In Israel, and I think this is, you know, when Dr. Korn and I spoke about this before the course even took off, he said, what do you mean they don't have any trauma? I said, they don't have any trauma. Like the volume of penetrating trauma or even blunt, severe blunt trauma with our highway systems and the epidemic of gun violence here is not comparable to anything that their trauma surgeons would ever see in a lifetime. And that's really the truth, even in time of war, right? If you think about it.
Yeah, that's hard to believe, Anna, because obviously we follow the mainstream media here. And I would personally think the opposite, that if any place the trauma Israeli trauma doctors should be teaching the U.S. trauma doctors. Yeah. You say the opposite is true.
Is the opposite. Because in Philadelphia has a mass casualty every night. The definition of a mass casualty every single night. The trauma surgeons at Penn, at Temple, they're operating on gunshot wounds all night. There's nights where we don't stop operating at Cooper. part of the reason Shakar really wanted to do trauma in the United States is because he knew there's really no formal trauma training in Israel because there is no center that sees this type of penetrating trauma that we see here, right? In Las Vegas, in Pittsburgh, the areas in Chicago, you know, Chicago, basically you're operating from daytime to the next morning. So, and the skills that you gain by doing that many operations, you can't gain unless you're doing it every single day. It's like, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? So you come to the United States, you train in a trauma fellowship, then you go back to Israel, and then years go by, and you may have a terrorist attack, maybe. You may have a stabbing or a shooting, maybe in a bad area, or an attack on a bus in Jerusalem, maybe. But it's not the volume that we see here. And certainly some of the injuries that we do every week, the Israeli surgeons that we trained never have seen.
See, that's surprising. I mean,
it's not a like an ego thing or punitive thing. They just don't see the volume.
That's surprising to me. Like I said, I thought just the opposite, and you're really opening my eyes, and I'm sure some of our listeners' eyes. We're going to talk a lot more about the specifics, the clinical aspects of the ASSET program. But you talked about how much it costs to register in the States for that. Let me switch over to Phil. Phil, that's a lot. Yeah. That's a lot of shekels to bring this program to Israel. Talk about your involvement in how you got this course that Anna uses to train all her residents. How you were able to take it from the United States and bring it over to Israel.
So, Bob, you know, similar to what you're questioning Anna's line of reasoning, like how could they not have this skill set? We in America think. And the world of Israeli military, think the world of Israeli technology, Israeli know-how. They're the startup nation. They can do everything better than anyone else. And so we have them on a pedestal. But at the end of the day, if you think about it, they haven't been in a major war in 50 years. And they have isolated events, but isolated events is very different than mass casualties from a military experience, plus the type of penetrating or blunt trauma type of injuries that they've seen in the last year. So this really spoke to my heart. And I said, okay, well, what can I do? I'm not a trauma surgeon, but I could spring into action. And so I did. I started calling people. I opened up my checkbook. I started calling people that I know. And I said, hey, listen, we want to do this. And I reached my administrative leadership at Cooper and said, you know, what could we do? And And they were gracious enough to allow our team to dedicate time to go, but it was on me to raise some money. So I went to our local, some local people that have money, and also our local federation. So we have a very active, amazing local federation of Southern New Jersey that at the same time was raising large amounts of money. Those of us who live in the United States know that all the local federations had major fundraisers, and people were just, you know, very emotional, but they were also very, very ready to open up a checkbook. And, you know, that's what we do, right? We're good at writing checks when people need us. And, you know, this was really an easy time to raise money, unfortunately. So we went to our local federation leaders and I said, hey, listen, this is what we want to do. They were amazing. And they just opened up their hearts and their pocketbooks. And they said, well, how much money do you need? So said to Anna, what do we need? Like, what do we need? So we came up with an amount, said, no problem, we'll fund it. And so essentially within a short period of time, we were ready to go. And ready to go meant ordering cadavers and ordering materials and trying to get a team together and trying to figure out what exactly we need. And so Anna worked with the leadership team in Israel and really put together programs to get this thing going and get it off the ground. So financially, yeah, we're still in that process of continuing to raise money. We're going back to the well. We're asking for other people to help us, and we're hopeful as time goes on that in podcasts like this we'll share our experience and allow people to understand that supporting these kinds of programs are so impactful and so important to help people.
So your first trip over to Israel was when, Phil?
So the team went in March, and then we went back in September as a group. That was my first trip back. Anna went in March and went in September. And some of our key, like we had, well, Anna, who went in March?
So Dr. Trevanis went and Dr. Gross went. And also, I just want to mention, the ACID course is a very formal course. We had to ask permission from the American College of Surgeons. This is not just like a, hey, I want to teach a lecture. This is a very formalized thing. So, and the only reason Israel has never had this course in the history of its existence is Dr. Gross, who used to run JTS, the Joint Committee on Trauma, reached out to his friends and said, I need to bring this to Israel. And they allowed for this course. They had grant permission for us to bring the course, to formalize it, to then train Israeli surgeons to then eventually become instructors and then get them. So now when we go back, we teach with them. We collaborate with them. We go back and forth on ideas about what do you think would be useful. So it was a very, very formalized process. And the whole course, I don't think people really understand this fresh frozen cadaver concept. Each fresh frozen cadaver is $7,000. There's not one center in the Middle East that's doing fresh frozen cadaver courses. Not one.
So you're bringing them from the States, these fresh frozen cadavers over?
Coming from the States.
Wow. And you're able to get them through the Israeli security at the airport?
Yep. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. And
she's got a big suitcase, Bob. She has these big suitcases and we fold them. So it's really a very important process. And, you know, in Israel, there's a lot of regulations about how to handle dead corpses, right? There's a lot of religious regulations, especially in disposing them. So it's a serious process.
So this course, this ACID course, mandatory for trauma surgeons here in the United States?
For fellows, correct.
For fellows, okay.
Yep.
Never given before in Israel under the auspices of the American College of Surgeons. You need their approval. So how many cadavers did you take over the first time? So
the first time we had six. We ran two courses, one day and one the second day. It's an all-day course. It starts at 7, ends at 5. There's a pretest and a post-test so you can assess, you know, how do they do? How do they feel? The first time we brought six, and then the second time we brought three, but we used the three bodies on other things, which I can share with you, some of the other things we did.
Okay. So who is the audience now who during these two trips so far?
So the first course was a number of trauma surgeons that were trained mostly in the United States. There was a couple from University of Miami at Rider. There was one, my partner that I worked with, Dr. Goldstein, who's the head of trauma, Edith Wolfson. We had some people from Sheba, a couple of people from Ichilov, and then Soroka, Rambam. They came from all over, Poria, and each surgeon brought a resident as like a gift, right? And it's funny because as the residents came in, some of them were wearing their military uniforms because they had either just come from Gaza or were going to Gaza as active duty. They weren't going as physician medics. They were going just as combat soldiers. I thought that this was a really, really uplifting opportunity for them. Because again, that's probably a once in a lifetime opportunity to do a course like that, unless they go into trauma. And then the second course, we again trained more surgeons that could possibly be taking care of trauma patients. Because as you know, like on that day, every hospital became a level one trauma center, right? So even if you have the skills to do something to save somebody, you have the skills. We want to empower you. And that's the whole point of trying to train more people through the country.
Right. And Phil, they weren't just Israeli Jewish surgeons or doctors. Many Israeli Arabs participated. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, that was such an irony for us for me, obviously, and for us being there. But also, just to mention that we talk about Dr. Gross and we talked about Dr. Shavanis. They're not Jewish. They went there on their own time, and learning about the state of Israel. And when you hear news, it's an apartheid state, which is the biggest joke of all. As we know, Israeli Arabs, Muslims, Christians are very active in the medical community. And we had surgeons that were Muslims. We had surgeons that were Christians. And later you'll hear a little bit about the medics. I said the last week when we spoke about this at a local federation event, the first two medics I met, their first name were Muhammad. And, you know, what a twist of irony that is, that here we are as, you know, Americans coming there and we're training Israelis. And it is completely, you know, we say colorblind, I would say religious blind. It's basically, these are people that care to take care of people. And that's what we focus on. And that's what they focus on. And, you know, we don't ask people what their background is when we take care of them in the United States. We maybe culturally we're interested, but we take care of everyone the same. And similar in Israel, that's the way it is. And the providers, these doctors, these medics, didn't matter what their religious background is, we train them all. And that's very impressive.
Very familiar story to when I interviewed Dr. Mickey Halberthal from Rambam Hospital, the CEO, saying, you know, obviously that Saturday, October 7th, the majority of the staff at the hospital was non-Jewish, but they were all taking care of civilians and IDF soldiers. So that needs to be publicized more in the mainstream media. Anna, you talked about some of the specific situations. You said up to 40. But give us, we're not all trauma surgeons, but give us some of the examples of things that you use the human cadavers to teach the Israeli surgeons.
Sure. So it's broken up into portions. We really use the whole body and we focus on how, you know, what we find pertinent in trauma. So we start with lower extremities, right? So start with compartment syndromes. Then we go into major vascular injury, which is a huge deficit in training for most people. Most people don't see penetrating trauma to the femoral artery or the femoral vein, how to fix it, how to shunt it, how to expose it, popliteal artery injury, all things that come from lower blast injuries. That's part of the course. Then we move on to upper extremity, right? So upper extremity vasculature, also compartment syndrome of the upper extremity, brachial artery transections, massive hemorrhage, how to identify it, subclavian artery injury from penetrating trauma. And then we sort of move our way. Also, we do neck, carotid injuries, esophageal injuries, emergent airways, tracheal injuries. We move on to the thorax, major vascular injuries, cardiac injuries, whether it's a stabbing or a shooting, how to fix the heart, techniques to how to fix the heart, how to get into the chest, aortic injuries, and then we move on to the abdomen. So anything in the abdomen from solid organ injury to hollow viscous injury to major vascular injury, which is really the thing that gets most people, how to get proximal and distal hemorrhage control, how to triage what, you know, cavity you need to go into. So it's a packed day, packed. Wow.
Do you have to tailor the teaching to the specific injuries, maybe the shrapnel injuries or injuries from RPGs that you were seeing IDF soldiers
not really.
Suffered from?
No, not really. I think we were tailoring it more to what happened on October 7th, which was high caliber rifle injuries, not so much the RPG injuries that they're seeing on the battlefield right now. Although it's the same, I think shrapnel injuries, if you have a shrapnel injury to the lower extremity, it's not as dangerous as if you had, you know, a severe, you know, almost near amputation. Or if you had a gunshot wound from a sniper to, let's say, the neck or the lower extremity. So we were teaching more on that type of hemorrhage control. I think when we talk about RPGs and explosive injuries, a lot of that is like damage control, which is tourniquet placement, unsalvageable limbs, things like that.
Gotcha. Phil, you mentioned the second trip, which was your first trip. I believe Asset turned into Asset Plus. So there weren't just surgeons there. You had other healthcare practitioners. Tell us a little bit about that, Phil.
Yeah, that was fantastic. We had a whole bunch of medics that came and they really embraced and they really enjoyed the course because for them to be that exposed to this type of activity, you know, we talk about how trauma surgeons in Israel or general surgeons in Israel have this exposure. Can only imagine how the paramedics really ate this up. You know, I wanted to go back one second about the course, this asset course. You know, for me, it was the first time I had seen it. And what they do is they have a scenario, like 42-year-old person with this injury, and you have 20 minutes to do this surgery. And so they discuss ahead of time, you know, how to do it. Then there's a group that goes around the patient, the cadaver in this case. They do the injury, they have a certain amount of time, and it's a real simulation type thing. It's not just purely didactic. And having a cadaver there, although it's a little morbid, it is real. And, you know, they're not bleeding, obviously, but the reality is they're doing anatomic assessment and anatomic repairs to a cadaver. So it's really hands-on. But getting back to your first, what you just asked me about the medics, they were just really eating it up. And I think that there's, we talk about the future. I think the future of this is really to expand to medics and more of that across the country because I think they could really use it.
Great. Anna, you've been there.
I'm sorry, Bob. Can I just make a comment about the cadavers? I know there's a discrepancy between what some people understand as a cadaver. So, you know, this is not a cadaver that you would dissect in an anatomy lab, like a traditional medical student. It's not embalmed. This is literally when you defrost this deceased person, it literally looks like they just died. So their wow. blood vessels, when you cut into them, they have residual blood in them, but the tissue, and I don't know if you saw in the pictures, it looks real. All the internal organs and the bowel, it all is preserved. Another thing that we do is we do simulate an active hemorrhage model. We have these flow devices that we purchased that we brought with us. I smuggled them in my luggage, actually. I'm going to admit to it. We cannulate the femoral artery and we pump red dye through to simulate a hemorrhage model. We cut the vessels. We say, what would you do? All right, fix this, fix that. And we did the same thing for the paramedics with hemorrhage control, which they really loved.
What kind of feedback? I'm sure it was positive that you got from the paramedics and the surgeons after your two courses.
I mean, they were just so thankful and were like, oh my God, like we've never seen anything like this. This is so many operations. They haven't done a lot of these operations, which is some of even the senior surgeons were doing it for the first time.
Wow.
The paramedics, some of them have never seen a body like that or done anything on a body. So I think it was for them and to me was really endearing and to make them empowered to maybe have the skill to do the procedure to save somebody. We weren't necessarily changing any of the protocols. We weren't saying, hey, go out into the field and do this to the IDF soldiers. We were saying that if this soldier may need this to save their life, you at least feel like you've done it on a real live tissue. It's not like a rubber, model of doing a trach or an emergent airway. So they were, and actually by the time they took the course, we had dissected out all the anatomy. So they really understood, you know, where they were placing the IOs, where the femoral artery runs, if there's an injury, where you put the pressure for hemorrhage control. And it's not just, you know, haphazard. And my partners, John and Dr. Gross, taught really in a battlefield scenario way, right? So they're very familiar with teaching military medicine. So they said, hey, you have a soldier, somebody's shooting at you, right? This soldier has a wound to the groin. And we taught in conjunction with a couple of the Israeli surgeons that, you know, are on the 669 unit that do the medical evacuation, Dr. Barak Levitt. So he taught in conjunction with Dr. Shimonis on some of the scenarios, which I found to be so amazing because they kind of went back and forth and would ask them questions like, what would you do now? What would you do now? What would you do now? So
wow, it sounds like they learned an awful amount from you, from the U.S. team. Let me ask you a question, Anna. What did your team learn from your Israeli colleagues?
You know, it's hard for us at Cooper. We can't look vulnerable, you know. I think some of the things that, you know, we take away from their conflict is that less is more sometimes. You know, in America, we tend to like, you know, do needle decompressions. We do all of this stuff in the field that delays transport of patients to definitive care. And we've known this. There's a lot of literature on this and penetrating trauma, right? Time to definitive hemorrhage control is the key, right? You can pump 10 units of blood in somebody on the rig and they'll still die unless you say, you know, you get hemorrhage control. So some of the things that the IDF has been implementing in terms of like not doing needle decompressions, which we could be doing a better job on just looking at our own protocols, in terms of pre-hospital stuff and really reevaluating, like, is this beneficial or is this causing patients more harm? So that's something that I took away looking at our own like guidelines and stuff.
Great. Let's look a little bit to the future. Phil, two trips in the books already. Future mm-hmm. trips planned?
Yeah, Bob, we're ready to go. Ready for you to come.
Ready.
We're ready for you to come. But the reality is that we think, we know based on their feedback, we're inspired by them. So they're just an inspiring group of young people. They were mostly young. When I say young, someone like me in my 60s, for me, they were all younger than me. And I was like the old man on the trip. And at the end of the day, I really felt invigorated. I got so mm-hmm. much out of there. Mm-hmm. We had people, medics there that literally, or doctors there that were literally in our course, and that night they were going to Gaza and they were mobilizing up north. These are people that were literally sitting with us, and then we knew 2 hours later they were in the middle of a battle. And so they were very inspiring. What's in the future? We believe that there's a lot of opportunity for us to continue to teach and to help collaborate with the Israelis and grow this program, provide education, train the trainers. You know, that's what Anna was saying earlier, is really the initial idea is to train them. And then the second time that the team went, some of the people who were trained became trainers, right? So ultimately train the trainers, get them more and more comfortable, and then expand the program. We love the medic piece, maybe more for other doctors, maybe basic skills for other physicians, maybe med students, maybe bring more people from here to help with processes. You know, when I don't know specifically about other things, you know, initially when this thing started, I volunteered thinking that they need cardiologists, they need cardiology, they need therapists, and they need trauma people, right? So they needed people, psychologists, right? I'm sure many people who are listening to this similarly volunteered and waiting for a phone call. They didn't really need me, right? So at the end of the day, this is something that we know they need and we know they have. What struck me is there's a disconnect between the old, this is what they told me, is the old surgeons and the younger surgeons. The younger surgeons are like, come and help us, let's collaborate. They had a different attitude than many of the old surgeons, older surgeons in Israel. They're like, we know what we're doing, we got it, you know, we got it down. Whereas they were more interested in what's the best way to take care of these people. Let's try to save as many people. Everyone wants to save people, but they wanted to know state of the art, and they're really active, engaged, and energetic.
Wow. And a last question for you. All the hours, days, weeks you spent toiling surgical residency, trauma fellowship over the last 10 or so years of your life as a trauma attending surgeon, did you ever realize the rewards that you saw on your visits to Israel would pay off? All those hours would pay off by educating our Israeli colleagues in their time of need.
Did I think it would be during a war? No, I think yes. You know, I think at Cooper, we cultivate such an environment of like education and mentorship. Like I can't imagine, you know, when I speak to medical students and I wish that I could bring them, right? We talk about this all the time, and just even through AJMA, I was like, come with me. Like I would inspire people to just not like sit, right? Not to just talk about, oh, I'm a victim or I'm so angry, but like, do something, change, right? Become who you want to be. So for me, it was really, really natural to go. I'm really involved with students. I really love collaboration. I think there's so many levels that, you know, just on a personal level, just becoming friends with these people. We can, you know, talk about cases. We can text. We can have conferences. I think there's just so much opportunity. But for sure, it was always there. I just wish that we can motivate the next generation to be like these badass, you know, trauma surgeons, right? Which is what I want everybody to be. I want everybody to convert to be a trauma surgeon. And
even me. But I'll tell you what really inspires us is we wanted to make a difference. And I tell this to people watching what's going on in the United States on campuses and watching what's going on. I'm okay with people going to rallies, and I'm good with whatever you need to do to support, but become active. Don't be passive. Do something. Do a mitzvah. You know, do something to make a difference. And whether that's going to Israel and getting meals or whatever you do, find your passion, find your love, find your skill set. Obviously, our skill set is medicine, and you can hear Anna's passion, and you can hear how invested she is. She inspired me. And we, you know, fed off of that energy, and I continue to feed off that energy, and we're just continue to stay inspired. So to the people listening, get involved, be involved, do something, make a difference, make a change.
Absolutely. Anna, you talked about speaking with Dr. Shachar on his deathbed. It's been a few years now. You had a few programs. You're going to have more programs. What would you tell him today?
You know, interesting enough, his brother, who's a medical student at Hadassah, comes to the course, Royshi, and he's visited us. He's come to Cooper, and it's really great to see him. They look so much alike. And I think Shachar would probably criticize some of the things that I do, but he was kind of a jerk sometimes. But I think he would be really, really proud of this. I know his parents and his wife and his kids. And I, you know, like this type of legacy stuff, I would want his kids to come and see and say, wow, like dad wanted to bring this here. And, you know, sort of at his last months of life, he was able to sort of navigate how we can do this in Israel. So I think he would be really touched.
Wow. Such heartwarming words. Phil, Anna, on behalf of the American Jewish Medical Association podcast, I want to thank both of you for speaking with us today, and also for all your initiatives in educating our Israeli colleagues in the time of war. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.